I'm Vic Cohen, and it's a fair question. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. I'm Vic Cohen, and it's a fair question. It's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair question. I'm Vic Cohen, and it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair question.
Hello, this is Vic Cohen broadcasting live from Skid Row Studios. Yes, this is live in gorgeous downtown Los Angeles' Skid Row Studios. We are in Skid Row Studios, and we are not actually on Skid Row. Fortunately, we do have some shelter, but we are so close. Well, the name of the show is It's a Fair Question, because on this show, every question is a fair question. Yes, there is no question that is ever too personal or ever off limits. And tonight, we are going to talk about something that affects everyone. Yes, this is a big night. I am so excited about our show. And what I'm talking about is something that could affect you. It could be something that affects your friend, your best friend. It could be a family member. I'm talking about addiction, but not just any addiction. I'm talking about sex addiction. That's right. A little controversial. Some people don't even think sex addiction is an addiction. Our guest is going to clarify that with us. Many believe sex addiction is epidemic, that it's affecting society unlike any other time in our history, particularly because of porn addiction. And my guest tonight, our guest tonight, is going to address that as well. He is a sober coach. That's what he does. He helps people stay sober, particularly when it comes to sex. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? He's not stopping people from having sex. He's stopping them from acting out in an addictive way, staying away from pornography, I imagine. He helps people not see hookers. That sounds crazy the way I just said that. But that is what he does, that kind of stuff. His name is Tim Devitt. He's sitting across from me right now, and it's time we say hi to him. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Vic.
How are you?
I'm happy to be here.
I am thrilled to have you. Now, what exactly is a sober coach? Are you really just holding guys down who want to pick up hookers? You're like sitting on their shoulders and arms and saying, not tonight, guy.
Well, you know, you know, I wish it was that easy. You know, no, I have been into...
And Tim, can you get real close to that mic? I want to make sure everyone hears you really close.
All right, sure.
Yeah.
We better hear?
That's fantastic.
Cool. Okay. Well, I've been into coaching recovering addicts for some time now, and I consider that addictions are essentially addiction is addiction is addiction, you know, whether it's sex, whether it's gambling, whether it's drugs or alcohol. And my personal story is I got sober in AA. I was a drug addict and alcoholic and many, many years ago.
What were your
sober.
Drugs of choice?
I was a big juicer, you know. I love to drink, but
is that what a juicer is?
Yeah,
because it could be steroids, right?
Now it is. I guess that's probably dating myself a little bit. You know, I just love to drink, but
what were you drinking? Beer, wine, anything you get your hands on?
Anything, yeah.
How bad did it get?
It got real bad. I mean, it got bad. I thought like I was going to die. I was a young man. I got sober. I was in my 20s, you know, and I thought I was going to die. I felt old. And
why did you feel you were going
to
die?
I couldn't stop drinking. And the only way to feel, I felt this terrible hollowness inside and this terrible pain inside. And the only way I could feel better was to take a drink or take a drug.
Were you cognizant of the pain? Did you actually know it was there?
Oh, yeah. And I knew that the only way to feel a little better was to take another drug or take another drink. And I also knew that was killing me. So it was like a cycle I couldn't get out of, you know. And, something inside me, and you hear this a lot if you ever go to AA meetings, you know, you hear this, there's like a light, there's like a sort of glimmer of hope, you know, so okay, maybe I can get out of this, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I did, I quit drinking, and that was like, you know, almost 40, that was 30 some years ago.
You went cold turkey?
Yeah, I did, yeah. And
when did you start drinking?
I started drinking when I was a real little kid, probably 10, 11, something like that. But you know, the thing about sex addiction is that you don't have to go to the liquor store. You don't have to pay some guy who's older to go in and buy it for you. You know, you don't have to do anything illegal. You don't have to buy joints on the street or whatever. So that's why I think a lot of kids get started in using sex as a way to alter their mood. Because essentially it's the same thing. Because what you're really doing is altering your brain chemistry. A drug addict is not really so much addicted to the heroin or the booze or sexual acting out. What he's addicted to is the alteration of his mood. He's addicted to the brain chemistry change.
Of the drug.
Of the drug, right. And you can get it. Gamblers get it by, you know, just letting it ride. Adrenaline junkies get it, jumping out of airplanes. You know, people get it from shopping. They get it from overeating, chocolate cake, you know. But essentially, it all comes down to the same thing. They're changing the neurochemistry of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And sex is particularly interesting, I guess. I mean, because, you know, you can put down the drink and never drink again, as I've did, you know, millions of people have done that. Or same thing with drugs. You can put it down and never do it. But you really don't want to live without sex. I mean, maybe some people do, but most people don't.
We're wired to procreate.
We're wired to procreate, and it's a great, you know, it's one of the great joys of life, you know? So you don't want to lose it. You don't want to say, well, I can't do that. And so the trick with addicts in that regard is, how do you develop a relationship with sex that's healthy and part of an intimate relationship, or it's life fulfilling, and it's not, you're not using it to alter your mood to escape from whatever your situation is.
So, Tim, just to clarify here, you're saying that one could abuse sex and create the chemistry and change the chemistry of the brain in a very similar way that perhaps a drug like cocaine or alcohol could change the chemistry of the brain. The difference being, with sex, it's happening, the individual can, is happening through an orgasm, is that right? Or through looking at pornography?
Many sex addicts, a lot of them really don't want to have an orgasm. They want it to last. They want to keep the high going.
The buildup before the orgasm.
Yeah, they get a little bit of a hit, and they just want to keep it rolling, you know. So, but in essence, it is, you know, the pleasure centers of the brain are in this middle part of the brain. I mean, I'm not a brain scientist. I don't think you are either.
The limbic
system, right.
Yes.
It's the old sort of lizard brain, you know. Mm-hmm. And when an addict is in his addiction, excuse me, they describe it as a cow path right to the pleasure centers in that particular area of the middle brain.
Regardless of what the addiction.
Right, regardless of what the addiction is. And what happens is the brain is then flooded with these pleasure chemicals. Primarily dopamine, you know.
Whether it be cocaine, heroin, or sex?
Yeah. I mean, they're different chemical. They're different, you know, neurotransmitters. Like with, if it's in a stimulating drug like cocaine or meth, then, you know, there might be more norepinephrine, which is like adrenaline, you know. But the primary pleasure chemical is dopamine. What happens is that an addict will flood the brain with dopamine, and they get in this what they call the dopamine depletion syndrome, which means your brain is producing, you're artificially producing so much of this stuff that your brain shuts it down, so it stops producing it under normal circumstances. So the receptors actually start dropping off, so you're not getting any. So you feel, under normal circumstances, you feel kind of lousy.
So is this from, this can happen from too much sexual activity?
Yeah. People use sex for it, and people use, all these other.
Well, like how much are we talking here? I mean, most men in America look at pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about looking for 10 minutes a day? What's the threshold? Where does it become a problem? Or how can someone listening say, hey, I might have a problem?
It becomes a problem when it's a problem. I mean, that sounds glib, but that's really the issue. You know, if it gets in the way of your life, you know, I mean, if you can't stop it, if you say to yourself, I'm only going to look at this for 10 minutes and you end up and next thing you know, the sun's coming up, you know, you got a problem, you know,
right.
Or if you're in your office and, you know, you have to shut down your computer because the boss walks in. You got a problem, you know. Or if you're hiding something and lying to your wife, you got a problem, you know. If you're just doing stuff that's in the open, you have control over it, you can stop it whenever you want, then you probably don't have a problem, you know.
It's kind of like to test if they're an alcoholic, do some test drinking. See how, if you can stop. If it's something that's not controlling your life. You're not a slave to it.
Yeah, I mean, an alcoholic will say, I can stop drinking anytime. And you can say, well, go ahead. Stop drinking, you know? So, well, I could if I wanted to. I don't want to, you know? Someone who doesn't have a problem with alcohol would probably never say I can stop drinking anytime. It would never occur to them.
Right.
You know?
Because I'm not an alcoholic.
Right.
And I don't have an issue around alcohol at all. I've never had to say or think. It doesn't come up.
It doesn't come up, exactly, right. You don't go around telling people that you don't have a problem.
Correct.
Right.
So as a sober coach who focuses on sex addiction or sex addicts, what exactly are you doing? I mean, is there a guy that you like be hired to hang out with someone 24 hours and literally keep them from looking at porn and going to hookers?
Here's the problem with the problem with addicts living in our culture. The problem with our culture, we have a very sick society, and we get all the wrong messages. You know, we get all the wrong messages. We get all these messages telling us if we do this, we're going to be happy. You know, if we drink this beer, we're going to get this girl. If we drive this car, we're going to be six, whatever. We're getting all the wrong information because we're getting bombarded with information saying, if you do this, you'll be happy. If you do this, you'll feel better. If you do this, those problems you have now will be diminished.
But it does feel better sometimes if you're driving a nicer car.
Okay.
It's undeniable.
Okay, true. But it doesn't solve the problems that it purports to solve.
Correct.
And for addicts, it's particularly difficult because addicts, well, not to get too kind of, addicts generally develop a kind of strong codependency early in life. You know, they did some studies. They found out that many addicts, like a large majority of addicts, experience some kind of trauma, neglect, or some kind of traumatic event or a lot of neglect in their childhoods.
This is all addicts?
Most addicts.
Okay. It's not particularly just sex addicts or alcohol
addicts.
No.
Actually, addiction, you know, addiction is addiction. And it's just, it doesn't differentiate that much. I guess you could say that if someone is sexually abused when they're a kid, they're probably more likely become a sex addict than to become a heroin addict.
Isn't it true that most sex addicts have a cross addiction, that most have a second addiction or a primary addiction? In other words, it's oftentimes the sex addict has two addictions.
Addictions migrate. You know, what happens to a lot of people, and this is how I got into dealing with sex addicts and porn addicts, is that you put down one drug and you pick up another one. The addiction migrates because you take care of one thing, but you're really just taking care of the symptom. You know, you're stopping the heroin or you're stopping the cocaine or whatever, but the addiction is going to rise up in some other way. It'll migrate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who are in treatment for sex addiction, for instance, were sober. You know, they were drug addicts who got clean, or they were sober alcoholics who got sober. You know, and then they developed this addiction later on. The addictiveness. John Bradshaw calls it addictiveness.
Bradshaw is a very popular, well-known self-help author.
Yeah,
who wrote a lot about the child, the inner child.
He wrote a lot about the inner child and about families and the damage that can be done when a child is brought up feeling a lot of shame. You know, and the problem with a lot of addicts is they do feel a lot of the shame, and they feel a lot of. They feel
shame about their addiction, or shame that came from childhood that then, because of the shame, leads to them trying to medicate through the addiction.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a thing that they call carried shame, which is that kids pick up shame. Somebody does something shameful to a child, and the child takes on the shame because children don't have good boundaries.
As if they were responsible.
It doesn't belong to them, but they take it on.
Okay.
You know? And so they go through, and so a lot of these kids go through life, and they develop these core beliefs that are distorted about themselves,
such as I'm not lovable.
I'm not lovable. Nobody ever loved me,
and no one will love me.
No one will love me. If they really knew me, they would never love me. If they knew my deepest, darkest secrets, they wouldn't love me. They wouldn't be with me. They would leave me. I'd be alone.
And isn't it often not just about other people loving them, but also I don't love myself.
Yeah, they internalize it. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I'm no good.
That's the big one. I'm no good. I'm not enough. I'm not enough, you know. And when addicts develop this early in life, so then then you get this lifelong habit of looking to someone else or looking outside for approval. Because there's a book called A Drama of the Gifted Child.
Alice Miller. Yeah.
And she talks about the gaze. She talks about the mother's gaze. And if the infant, with the little infant brain, you know, every infant, whether it's what kind of animal, you have instincts to survive. In our little infant brain, if we get the gaze from mom, then we know we're going to be okay. We get that connection. We get that idea that, okay, I'm going to be safe. They're going to take care of me here. But if we don't get that, then the infant brain shifts. And instead of feeling like, oh, I'm okay, I can just live my life and be myself, the infant brain goes into the mode of codependency, which is, excuse me, what do I have to do to keep this woman near me? Excuse me, there's a frog in my throat. So they start looking outside for what really they need to look for inside. You know?
And how does that connect to sex addiction and porn addicts? Because that's where they're going? Numb out the feelings that are uncomfortable, the feelings of self-hate?
Well, that's part of it, yeah. Yeah, the feelings of that I'm not enough, the feelings of self-hate, you know, and it's a numbing thing, and it's a way to make the situation tolerable, you know, if their situation is not really tolerable.
Now, real quick, that book, Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, is a classic book. Mm-hmm. So those of you who are into self-help and into introspection, I think you would really enjoy that book. It's a pretty fascinating book. And in a sentence or two, Tim, can you tell everyone what you feel that book is about? It's kind of what you were just talking about.
Yeah, it's essentially about the development of what we call codependency, you know, which is a distortion of you cannot be yourself if you're looking for someone else to what you should do.
But it is kind of human nature, Tim, right? That we feel good when the boss says great job, or if a spouse or girlfriend says you look really sexy, or I love when you do that. Or now, I suppose the difference being feeling good is different from needing to, you know, all my survival being on those comments.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also if your girlfriend says, wow, you really look good, you feel great. But if your girlfriend says, that shirt, man, that sucks, man, you look terrible. If you're healthy, if you're in a good place, you'd be able to say, okay, well, the shirt's lousy, but I'm still okay. But if you're in a bad place, you'd say, I'm really terrible. There's something really wrong with me that I would pick out that shirt, you know? What's wrong with me? You know, I must be really, you know, I don't have any sense of fashion or anything, you know? There's something terribly wrong with me.
So it's not right-sized, the amount
it's it's the difference between, like, shame and guilt, for instance. Like, guilt is, you feel guilty if you do something wrong, do something bad. You say, okay, I did something, I messed up, I'm sorry. You feel guilt about it. Shame means you are wrong. There's something wrong with you. It's internalized.
One's entire being.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, I'm still curious about what it means to be a sober coach for a sex addict.
Yeah.
I will assume that you worked with and have worked and currently working with many celebrities since we are in Los Angeles. Would that be fair to say? It's a fair question, Tim.
Well, just by the nature of the question, I can't answer it.
But you would it be a fair question? Here's and I know the answer. I'm going to ask the question,
yeah. And
then I'm going to answer it for you.
All right.
The question is, you obviously work with high profile people, many of which the names we would likely recognize. And the answer you would give is, I can't tell you that. And then I would say, well, you charge a lot. I mean, being a sober coach, you basically are owned by this person 24/7. That must cost money. And the answer is, they're people who have money.
People who can afford it, yeah.
And often,
people who need it, you know.
Right. What is it, again, like, are you slapping the credit card out of a guy who's about to call a hooker on the phone?
No, it's very different. It's very different. I work with them. My training is as a counselor, as an addiction counselor. So I'm a certified addiction counselor as well as a certified coach. So I do those two things. And it's a lot of it is counseling, and a lot of it is helping the addict understand what's going on at any given moment. What essentially what the sober coach does is it helps the addict get from point A to point B. addict can put down the drug, or in the case of sex, he can stop acting out. He can stop going to strip clubs. He can stop doing the porn. He can stop going to massage parlors. It doesn't matter what they do. But in real life, he's going to reach a point where the stressors of life are going to are going to make him want to do that.
And there are hers in this too.
And there are hers. There aren't as many women, or women aren't owning up to it as much. Let's say that.
Right. So, okay, getting back to this. So, are you literally traveling on the road with some of these men?
I have done that. Yeah.
And so, the life stress of life is getting overwhelming.
Yeah.
For one of your clients.
Yeah.
And that's a time where perhaps they're very vulnerable to acting out through some type of sexual activity.
Right.
And
then
you step in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So you have to have a very tight relationship with your client for them to. Because it doesn't help if they call you after they've been to the right?
Right. Well, that's what they like to do, you know, yeah.
Does that happen?
It happens all the time, yeah.
You'll be out on the road with someone, and they'll call you up in your hotel room and say, Tim, I did something bad just now?
Well, not exactly, but close to that, yeah.
Or, Tim, I need to talk to you? And you go, what happened?
Say, why didn't you call me beforehand?
Right.
Well, you know, I thought about it, but blah, blah, blah. You know, I didn't think, you know, whatever. I didn't think. That's the key thing.
That's disheartening, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's part of the deal. It's part of the deal. It takes a long time. It's like an addict, any kind of addict, whether you're a sex addict or a drug addict. You spend your life medicating your feelings and finding inappropriate ways to handle your stress. You know, you handle your stress in ways that are not really useful. They're only useful in that moment. So once you get sober and you stop doing whatever you're doing, you have to find new ways to handle the stressors of life. You have to develop new habits. And you have to develop a new understanding of how to get through those times when the compulsion is so strong that you think you can't do anything about it. It's like you're powerless over it.
Right. But isn't there an argument to be made that having you around is perhaps a crutch and not allowing the addict to stand on their own two feet and use the tools of their recovery like anyone else, such as I would imagine calling their men with similar problems, calling you the sponsor, right? You're not their sponsor, but they have a different person who's a sponsor. Like, isn't it perhaps making them rely on you in a way that's not really healthy? Because it's not you can't be there every day of their life.
It's temporary. And it allows them some breathing room. It allows them some space to begin to understand what they're capable of and what is dangerous for them. You know, it's a safe place for them to sort of step back into life without their acting out behavior.
What about someone listening who says, I've not lost anything in my life. I have a job. I'm married. I have kids. I make really good money. I went to a great school, great college. Look at porn every day for a couple hours and masturbate in the morning and masturbate at night to go to bed. Okay, so what? So I've had, maybe cyber sex. I like going to strip clubs. I mean, my life is still really good. My wife loves me. I mean, what do you say to that person?
Does your wife know?
Well, why would she need to know? It's porn. It's not a big deal. I mean, I'm not cheating on her.
Well, it depends on how you look at it, I suppose. You're taking a part of your relationship with your sexuality, which if you're in an intimate relationship, committed intimate relationship, your sexuality is part of that. You're taking that away.
Okay, and just to be clear, that was me role playing. I'm not married, and I'm not looking at porn. And I want to make this is something I want to make really clear. And I've never talked about it, and I want to. I have a real problem about pornography, Tim, and I think that it's we have a thing in this country of glorifying it. We've got teenagers wearing shirts that say hustler or playboy and other provocative sayings that support the pornography industry. And I think there's a real misunderstanding out there about how destructive pornography is and how it's destroying people's lives. And I just don't, we have this thing out there where it somehow seemed as cool, but it's not cool. I mean, you're seeing it up in the front lines, aren't you, Tim?
Yeah.
I mean, I read online, and you can probably confirm this for me, that a big issue now, among guys in their 20s is ED, erectile dysfunction. Now, a normal 20-year-old male, 25-year-old male, should have no problem having an erection. But we're finding that suddenly all these young men are having a problem having sex with their girlfriends. And what is the common denominator? Excessive masturbation and porn use. Correct, Tim?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. There was actually, they did a study. They were trying to do a study. This doctor up in Toronto was trying to do a study on porn use among young men. And they had to cancel it because they couldn't get a control group because they couldn't find any young men who didn't use porn.
Yeah.
There were like none. So they couldn't do the study, you know.
Well, and what's happening now and what's very exciting about what you did do, Tim, in your career is you're really, as you know, you're in the very early stages of something, as Patrick Carnes has said, who's really the forefather of really defining sex addiction as an addiction, that we're looking at a tsunami. I'm sure you've heard him say that, correct?
I have heard him say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and describe the tsunami to me.
Well, you know, I started off earlier talking about how our society gives us, you know, we get the wrong message. We get these distorted messages. We get they're almost delusional ideas about what we should do. And part of that is this whole idea of using sex in this way, that it's objectified, it's dehumanized. When we're looking at porn on the internet, we're not looking at women, we're looking at pixels. There's no women there, they're pixels, you know? And there's no relationship there. As I was saying earlier, it takes away from the idea of having an intimate human relationship, person-to-person relationship. You know, if we look at porn, we can see more sexual imagery in a minute than our ancestors saw in their whole lifetime, you know? And our brains aren't equipped for that. Our brains are not equipped for the speed and intensity of that kind of imagery. And unfortunately, what happens is that we begin to, this is what happens to the young men, we begin to substitute intensity for emotion. So we go for intensity. Intensity is the only thing that works.
The intensity meaning the graphic nature of the pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And from my understanding, from what I've read, that just like a drug addict needs to get a bigger hit by taking a bigger dose and then switching to a harder drug, we're seeing the same thing with pornography, and that someone may start out with a softcore porn and eventually they get kind of so used to the softcore, they need something bigger and more stimulating to their mind, which means more hardcore stuff. And before they know it, they're looking at stuff that never even interested them. Correct?
It's tolerance. It's the same thing as a drug tolerance. You know, if you have a pill problem and you start off, you're taking 4 Vicodin in a day, a couple months later, you'd be up to 10 or 12. And then, you know, 6 months later, you're taking 30, 40 pills a day.
Right. Why is it, Tim, and this is what makes me very upset. Why is it that this is not talked about more? I mean, we need to let people know what's going on. There are people, there are boys. The average age of a first-time porn user is 11 years old. So you've got... And because 11-year-olds now are growing up in a internet age, I mean, at least when I was young, you had a fight to find porn. It was a tough thing to find a Playboy. You know, I mean, it would take a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was in the drugstore, but they had covers at the head, like where I was. they had them covered up, you know. Like,
right. But now these kids, they go unmonitored. And you parents listening, you're insane if you don't have a blocker on your kid's computer. And I'm not trying to offend you, put you down, but you're not living in reality. Because if you don't know what your kid's doing out there, you might as well put them on a street corner somewhere and just leave them there.
Well, kids are curious, you know. Kids are curious and they're going to want to see whatever they can see.
And curiosity is healthy.
I think
but
that
a parent needs to monitor what they're doing, looking at their history. And
yeah.
I would never, I don't have kids, but I'm telling you, Tim, if I did, I would not allow them to have a computer at home in the bedroom.
Yeah.
If it were at home, it'd be in the middle of the home. They wouldn't have any access on their cell phones to internet use.
Yeah.
Because I understand it's a problem because of what all I've read. And I think parents really need to take this seriously.
I think one of the reasons we don't hear people talk about it is because there haven't been, it's relatively new, the whole, you know, the internet porn has not been around that long, so there are not a lot of consequences for it, you know. And the consequences are only now just beginning to be understood. And once the consequences start being understood, then there will be more talk about it and more attention paid to it.
Well, it's just shocking to me how little people know. You know, before I did the show, you and I were briefly speaking about a website that we both found really interesting called, and if you at home are, or wherever you are, would like more information about this, go to Your Brain on Porn. No spaces between the words, Your Brain on Porn. The videos they have there are fascinating. Now, where I'm coming from, I'm not coming from a religious standpoint here. I have no judgment. There's no moralistic or theological perspective on this.
Yeah.
I could care less about that. Yeah. Where I see, where I get frustrated is that I think that I hate seeing people hurt themselves. Yeah. And because on that site in particular, and there's some other great videos online, what I've learned, and Tim, please correct me if I'm wrong, but literally pornography changes the actual map of the brain. A frequent addictive pornography user, actually, if you were to take a MRI or some other scan of their brain, would be different than a brain of a man or a woman who is not a frequent addictive porn user. Am I correct, Tim?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you are correct.
No one talks about that. I mean, this isn't like casual. This is a big deal. People's their brains are literally changing.
Yeah, I mean, people don't understand it. Like I said, saying there are no consequences to it. You know, I mean, a friend of mine, Rob Weiss, wrote a book about internet porn, and and what Rob's findings were that, essentially the stimulus is so rapid and so fast changing and so stimulating that the brain really, our brains are not, they're not set up to function that way, you know? So that's why that you would see those chemical changes in it, because the brain is furiously trying to cope with all this information and all this stimulus, you know? So it's a problem. And it's, but you know, I look back on, I saw this photograph. I was doing some research on, early AA a while back, and I came across this photograph, and it was a photograph of Bill Wilson.
Bill Wilson is the founder of AA,
and a few of the other guys who were around at that time, and they were sitting at a conference table having some kind of meeting, and they were all wearing masks. They were wearing like Lone Ranger masks, and it was just kind of silly to see these men in suits and sitting there doing business wearing these masks. And then when you realize, well, that was okay, that was like 1939 maybe, so it wasn't that long ago that being an alcoholic was so shameful that these guys had to wear masks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, out here in Hollywood, you know, if you're not in recovery, you know, you're nowhere, you know. I mean, it's like a badge of honor.
Suspect that the sex stuff's not as hip.
It's not, but what I'm saying is this is coming along later on.
You think 10 years from now?
10, 15 years, yeah.
Well, how many scandals do we have to see before it becomes obvious there's...
harder. It's just harder because there's so much shame involved in it. There's so much secrecy involved in it. I mean, I talk to a lot of guys who are married, middle-aged men who act out with other men.
Are they gay?
They have sex with their wives. They say they love their wives. They also have sex with men in secret. So they lead two lives.
Is it because they have an interest in both sexes, or is it often because their addiction has gotten so out of control that they need a new high, something they've never done before, so they go to someone of the same sex?
That's a good point, Vic, because I think it's a little both. I think sometimes it's both things, and sometimes there's another point to it too, which is sometimes it's a reenactment of a trauma from youth, you know? A lot of guys were sexually abused when they were kids, and then they act out with men as a sort of reenactment of that, you know?
So a wife of a sex addict, should she feel sorry for him?
She should understand that he's sick, you know? It's very difficult because he's also been lying, you know? He's also been hiding and lying, and, you know?
Well, if we were to talk to a woman who's had a husband serial cheating on her, I think we'd have a hard time finding sympathy.
Yeah, it sure would, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really tough. It's helpful when I'm working with addicts. I try to help them understand that an addict is a perpetrator, in this case, but also a victim. And you have to try to get your mind around both those things, you know.
when you treat a sex addict who's been a serial cheater on either a spouse or a girlfriend, you do something called full disclosure. I believe you've mentioned, or I was talking to someone else in your field that would talk around this.
Generally, full disclosure is important. If you want the relationship to continue, full disclosure is important.
So full disclosure means, honey, for the last 25 years, I've slept with more than 60 hookers and have spent over $500,000.
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes that's what it takes. Yeah.
And what happens in that room?
Good question.
You're there, right? As a coach, as a...
One of three things happens. They either split up, the woman leaves, says, screw you, you know, she hires some lawyer and takes what she can get. That doesn't happen that frequently. What happens most frequently is that they stay together and they do one of two things. They either slog through it, and it's difficult, it takes time, or they do what we call a therapeutic separation. So they separate for a while to give themselves time to work through, to give the woman time to work through the feelings of betrayal. Because she's been traumatized, you know. She's been traumatized and betrayed and lied to, and she's had the pins pulled out from under her, you know. It's like Maslow's, pyramid of needs, you know, human needs. She's had, like, the bottom layer just sort of, like, wiped out, you know. So that takes time. So, you know, as difficult as these things seem, they work out. Because most of these guys will say, I would never, ever, in a million years, tell my wife what I did. Never. Never. But then somehow they come around to doing it. And when they do, then they can start to feel whole again, and they can start to live in an authentic, integrated fashion.
Well, tell me if I'm wrong here, because my guess is the reason that works so well is because it puts the addict in a place of reality. And for so long, the addict, in this case the sex addict, has been fooling himself and believing that whatever he was doing wasn't really affecting other people, and was really it was really a big fantasy, in a sense, living a lot in fantasy. And when you got to tell your wife that for 25 years you've been lying to her face, you get caught. You meet reality fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they have been delusional. They've been delusional and in fantasy. And you're right in that they develop this double life, and they think, you know, well, okay, this isn't hurting anybody else. I'm just doing this, you know.
If a guy cheats on his wife once, does that make him an addict?
No.
Well, here's my answer to that question. Mm-hmm. I would say it depends what else he's been doing.
Well, exactly.
I mean, if he's been looking at porn 12 hours a day and he's only had one affair, because like you were saying, it's a big picture.
It's a big picture. Right. And you know what? People fall for other people all the time, you know?
I see. Okay.
People see other people and say, wow, you know, and situations are such. But the thing that will destroy a relationship faster than anything is the secrets, the double life.
Mm-hmm.
Because the guy in this situation, he has this feeling that if she really knew me, she'd be out of here.
And this is the mindset of a married guy or a guy in a relationship.
Yeah. If she really knew me.
Not because of the acting out, but necessarily partly because of that. Because if they really knew who I was as a human being.
Right.
And then add on the
all the acting out stuff, you know, and then they just say she would never stay with me.
Right. And in that case, she may not.
She might not. She might not, but she might. And if she does, then they have a chance for a truly... integrated relationship.
Well, what's in it for the woman? I mean, this guy's been cheating on her forever.
Maybe she loves the guy. Maybe she digs him. Maybe they have a good time. Also, you know, I mean, she will almost certainly have her own issues around being hooked into a relationship, you know, because that's part of this too. You know?
Well, Tim, I believe in the idea, I'm sure you've heard this, that water seeks its own level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a relationship, if water seeks, and particularly in relationships, meaning if the sex addict or any addict has a woman in his life, or if he's gay, a guy in his life, there's something there that's at the same level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, which means that partner does have a part in this. A very healthy person isn't going to stick around long, correct?
It's a good point. In general, a woman would not want to settle for that kind of half a person in her life, you know?
Because even if the guy doesn't admit He's still not around.
He's not there.
Mentally.
Exactly.
This is another important thing, I think, is regarding the porn. I don't think men realize, and if you guys, if you're looking at porn all the time, you've got a relationship. It's with your porn. And if you think because you got a wife or a girlfriend, yeah, she's around, but you're depriving her, as you said, Tim, you're depriving her of all of you. And I do look at it as cheating, and I sound like a total buzzkill. But you know, I don't care.
It doesn't have anything to do with morals.
I don't have a moral thing about it. I'm like, if you want to be married or you want to be in a relationship, give that woman everything. And if you don't, fine.
Some guy asked me, he said, well, what's wrong with me going to a massage parlor? I'm going to stop at the massage parlor and I get a massage with a happy ending.
Meaning, a woman will manually stimulate a man to climax.
Okay.
Is there anyone who's not sure what a happy ending is?
Okay.
Go on.
So, and my answer to that is that's fine if you want to do that and if your wife's okay with it.
Right.
That's all.
Right.
If she's okay with it, fine. Go ahead.
And this is the thing that I don't think guys... Now, that seems really obvious to me. To some guys, it isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the more subtle thing is this porn stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because
suddenly
your wife, I don't care who she is, she's not looking good compared to what's on the screen.
Right.
You know, you see these guys who are married to...
You asked me what we do as coaches, a sober coach. And one of the things the number one thing is to try to help guys... develop a new relationship with their sexuality, which is the sexuality as a part of an intimate, romantic, committed relationship. Or not necessarily, I mean, it could be serial monogamy,
whatever.
What if a guy's single?
Then
fine, he's with his girlfriend for a while.
No, single with no one. What's healthy sexuality if a guy's alone?
Well,
like Jeremy here, this guy, he's very lonely. Jeremy? What's healthy sexuality for him?
Well, I think that's a little tricky because, I'm
not alone.
Well, you're alone a lot. He's a serial. He goes from one guy to one guy.
One guy.
I'm gay too.
No, there's nothing wrong with being gay.
No.
But what about a guy like Jeremy if he's alone and doesn't have, what's healthy sexuality for him?
Well, the problem with
our producer,
with those kind of relationship, the problem with short-term relationships is that sex gets introduced, in my view anyway, sex gets introduced way too early. And sex is way too powerful, and it overwhelms the rest of the relationship, you know. So a good, when I say an intimate relationship, I mean an intimate. It doesn't have to be a long-term marriage.
No, but this is what I'm talking about, Tim.
Yeah.
We have a lot of single listeners here. They don't have a woman in their life.
Right.
Guys like Jeremy.
Right.
Forget about other women. What is healthy sexuality with oneself when there's no one around, whether it be a guy or a girl?
With sexuality with oneself.
Yes. What is healthy? What is it? Is it health? Are we talking a healthy way of masturbating?
Masturbation can be healthy. Sure. Yeah, it can be. It depends on what you fantasize to. And
there's
what
such
you
a thing
use,
as
you know.
Well,
you
hold on a second.
Yeah.
There's such a thing as unhealthy fantasizing.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, why? It's just in your head. No one. You're not doing anything.
Well, because you're introducing shameful. Sometimes you could be introducing things that are shameful to you.
What if that turns the person on?
Well, then you're gonna get turned on, and then afterwards you're gonna feel ashamed. You're gonna say, "Oh my God, I was watching this woman with a dog, and now I feel just horrible about myself." Where are you then? You know.
So, but forget about watching. You're saying even imagining.
Right, or even imagining. You know,
fantasy.
Yeah. So then that's just building more shame. That's just feeding the shame.
So when Jeremy is pleasuring himself, he should not be thinking about himself with a dog.
No, he should think about, I don't know, Sarah Palin or somebody. I don't know.
I said without a dog. No, that was too easy. I have no problem with Sarah.
I just said that.
I have no problem with Sarah Palin. I'm not trying to bash anyone here. But the point is, there is such a thing as even when one is not in an intimate relationship with someone, we're always in an intimate relationship with ourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we need to look at as well.
Right.
Indeed, when it comes to fantasy, during masturbation.
Here's the thing. There's this thing that they call blue balls. Forget about it. It's not real. You know? You don't have to have an orgasm. Can I say that?
Of course we can. You could say anything.
Guys say, oh, well, you know, I got to get released.
There is a discomfort. I mean, that comes from
a
reality of cramps.
There's a discomfort. You know, so what? We have a thing that gets rid of it. We have wet dreams. That's what happens.
Right.
That takes care of it. So what I'm saying is we feel this need. And whether it's societal, we say we're going to be a real studly kind of guy, so we got to get a woman or we got to do something. But we can do without for a period of time. That's fine.
Yeah, I've gone periods just for my own, kind of like a cleanse.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's been really interesting.
I think it's helpful. I think it's good.
So, and this is the other thing that I've read and seen online, that if one were a sex addict, in their mind, they're literally, their brain has changed, mm-hmm. that it can be unchanged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the brain is plastic that way. Yeah, it's
called
it'll,
neuroplasticity.
Right.
And they've discovered that if one were to no longer engage in those activities, such as pornography use and other addictive, harmful stimulants to the brain, that the brain will actually repair itself. But how long does that take, Tim? And what would
be... It takes a time. And that's what, when I was talking about being a coach and helping someone through this period of time, it's a finite period of time.
You know? What is a... I've been reading online a lot about rebooting the brain.
Yeah.
Now, and some talk about 90 days of no masturbation, no orgasm, and no pornography. What's your thought on that?
Okay. I think that's a good idea. I think it's an excellent idea.
90 days of abstinence.
Yeah.
Jeremy, could you go 90 days without an orgasm?
I don't think so, no.
What's the longest you've gone?
You mean with zero masturbation or
Nothing.
Probably tops, maybe a week.
Was that because you were ill and you couldn't perform it, or because it was a deliberate choice?
Most likely I was just busy, and, you know, when I'm busy, I don't think about it.
What's your average currently?
At least once a day.
Okay. So do you look at porn every day?
If I'm not with someone, then yeah, I'll use porn. But if I, you know, have a girlfriend, then I don't need that.
Is he an addict?
I would have no idea.
Tim?
I would have no idea.
Well, doesn't
sound like an addict.
Well, we
know.
Have
could for, be though.
We don't know because we haven't really explored.
Right, we don't know. Yeah.
Have you ever paid for sex?
No.
Do you go to strip clubs?
Yes.
How often?
Maybe once every 3 months.
Have you ever hired a prostitute?
No.
Have you ever had a happy ending in a massage?
No.
Okay. Well, we got to hook him up to a lie detector.
Okay. That's funny.
And he's got some company here. He's got a lady in the other room, so I don't know.
Yeah. So
he's got to watch what he says here.
Right.
We'll talk to him privately
right,
later.
Yeah, right, okay.
We'll have a private consultation. Okay. Well, and also I did put him on the spot there. But it is a fair question. I mean, if you're going to be in the room, things like that are going to happen, Jeremy.
You know, that's a good idea. When you talk about 90 days, something like that, that's a good idea.
But this isn't arbitrary. This is science, correct?
Yeah.
This isn't you just going, yeah, well, 90 days sounds good. I mean, there's actual studies that have shown that's a good...
It's the dopamine receptors start to rebuild. Because when you hit the dopamine depletion, the dopamine receptors start to drop off. So the brain's not producing enough dopamine. The receptors start to rebuild. And so you start to feel more normal under normal circumstances.
After 90 days.
After 90 days.
But I've heard that it takes 3 to 5 years for the brain to fully repair from this.
Yeah, that's a high estimate. I tend to think it's more like 18 months to 2 years.
Have you seen miracles in your work?
I see miracles every day.
Describe the biggest miracle you've seen.
That's a hard one. I can't really, you know, I mean, I don't have an anecdote that I can pull out and say, you know.
I suppose miracles are miracles.
But miracles are miracles. And they're so personal, you know, that I could say, you know, this one guy said to me that he drew a picture of himself drowning and he was reaching out and it was me. I was like, you know, grabbing him by the hand.
You were in the picture?
Yeah. And I was pulling him out of the water and he was drowning. And that really touched me, you know, because I thought, I really helped this guy, you know. But they're all miracles in a way, because you know, when I talk to somebody, I'll say something like, "Well, did you ever have any trauma or anything like that?" And they almost always say, "No, I had fine trauma." You know, I said, "Well, did your father beat you with a belt or anything like that?" No. Okay, well, anything. And then often it'll be like, "Well, there was this." One time, you know, or there was this priest or there was this guy who was just like my, you know, and he would start telling me these stories. And they weren't necessarily sexually graphic or sexually that traumatic.
Well, how's this one for you? Go on, and then I got to...
But they were bad enough that, See, if a kid is betrayed, if you use a child for your own use rather than taking care of them, because we're made to take care of our children and take care of their needs. When we use them to take care of our needs, that's a betrayal.
Well, I think it's his name's Ed Farmer, and I could be mistaken, but there's a therapist slash psychologist expert who coined the phrase or the idea of covert incest.
Yeah.
Or emotional incest. I believe he said covert, meaning there's no actual physical touching or sexual activity between the parent and the child, yet there's a unhealthy bond, almost a romantic energy.
It was Ken Adams, I think.
Ken Adams.
Yeah.
Farmer,
He wrote a book called...
Ken Adams.
He wrote a book called Silently Seduced about that.
Okay. Yeah. That's who I'm remembering. Yeah. And the idea is that so if someone were to look back at their childhood and there was no priest and there was no bad, but perhaps there was, and that's the subtleties of this, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, you take a little boy and say, okay, now you're the man of the house, you know, because your daddy left, you know. Well,
or daddy's coming home late or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, kid's 8 years old. So how am I going to be a man of the house? You know, I don't even know how to be a boy yet. You know what I mean? So it's like the set up for failure, saying, well, I'll try to be a man, but I don't, you know.
And how does that turn into addiction?
Well, it's you start to look outside, you know, or you could just say, I mean, sometimes that's an intolerable situation. It's just so stressful for the child. Can't deal with it.
So they might numb out.
They would numb out. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if I had a daughter, I would tell my daughter that if you are dating a guy who's regularly looking at pornography, regularly going to strip clubs, I would say he's not right for you. I would say this guy's not grown up. This guy is not going to be there for you in the way you need to be treated. And I know that sounds really over the top. Like, I would say if the guy wants a big bachelor party with strippers, he's immature, not ready. What do you think?
Well, what you just described is someone who is certainly not ready for any kind of relationship, you know?
Right, but women, you know, they're guys. I was one of them years ago when I wanted a bachelor party, and I did have one, and I would never now. I was different back then, but... Yeah. You know, I was like, what? You're not, or they say, like, you can't look at porn. I'd be like, what are you talking about? You're not in charge of my penis.
Right.
You don't get a say in that.
But we get all the wrong information, you know. People say, you talk to a guy, say, well, you know, I'm really looking for a woman to settle down with, you know, and to have a relationship and have kids. And you say, well, what are you doing about it? Well, I go to the gym and I work out, you know, I'm looking really good, you know. It's like, what the fuck is that, you know? That's not the way to get there, you know?
Right.
You don't get if you want to go from Los Angeles to Chicago, you know, and you head south, you're not going to get there, you know?
Right.
So, you know, that's the challenge, you know, is to help people understand and continually. That's why it's the daily thing, because every time you turn around, I'll tell you the best thing I ever did. I got rid of my television set. I never watched television. I just got rid of it. I have a computer, so I watch movies and all that stuff. But, you know, the distorted, delusional messages we get are just make all this stuff that much harder. You know?
Mm-hmm. So let's say someone listening is finding this particularly personal to them. Maybe they think, well, I might need some help in this area. I'm kind of curious. Or perhaps they have a spouse or a boyfriend or a girlfriend. What do they do?
Well, there are a number of things to do. I mean, they could go to my website, which is lasobercoach.com.
That's all one word, LA. So what if they don't live in Los Angeles?
I do coaching over the telephone. So okay. I mean, that's a possibility. But I would also suggest, you know, they have these 12, they have 12-step meetings for sex addicts all around the country.
12-step being like AA, but only for sex addicts.
For sex, yeah.
What are those?
Well, one is called Sex Addicts Anonymous, and one is called Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. Those are the two big ones, and then there are a few others. You know, those are really helpful.
Tim, I wish we could keep talking. You've been an amazing guest. Thank you so much for listening, and I want to have you back. Does that sound okay sometime?
Okay, sure.
This is great.
That was great. Okay.
And thank you all for listening right here to It's a Fair Question. We'll talk to you soon. I'm Vic Cohen, and It's a Fair Question. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. I'm Vic Cohen, and it's a fair question. It's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair question. I'm Vic Cohen, and it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair, it's a fair question.